Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, November 27th. I'm Alan Shartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Poughkeepsie Public Library District and Friends of the Library, hosting Andrew Coe, author of A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression, POKLIB.org. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Frank Genovese of Ellis Medicine. He's here to answer your questions about a range of neurological issues. He's a neurosurgeon. Get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in early. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Genovese, your calls and much more all coming up on Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us on the Medical Monday this week is Dr. Frank Genovese, a neurosurgeon, practicing out of Ellis Medicine in Schenectady, New York, board certified in neurological surgery, graduated from the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science in Chicago. He treats people for a variety of neurological issues. Senator Genovese, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Good afternoon, Alan.
Great to have you here. The number to call, everybody, and people are getting on now, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. A couple of diagnostic questions, doctor, to begin with. The first is that there are neurologists and there are neurosurgeons. You're a neurosurgeon, but obviously you have to be conversant with everything that goes on in neurology also, right?
To a certain extent, absolutely, yes.
And so if somebody has brain surgery, something like that, that's what you would do?
Correct.
Okay. How about upper back surgery? Do they do that?
Yes, sir. Anything involving the nervous system, which would include, of course, the spine, peripheral nervous system.
Yeah. Okay. So but I do know, and one thing I want to say is that you're going to be giving a very interesting talk at Ellis this week, and why don't you tell us a little about that?
Yes, thank you. This coming Wednesday at 6 o'clock in the Ellis Auditorium, the Graham Auditorium, I have
a— That's at Ellis Hospital.
Ellis Hospital. I'm going to be talking, ask the doctor. In other words, hopefully the audience will come with questions. If not, I do have a canned talk with commonly and frequently asked questions involving my field.
Okay. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, welcome back. Go ahead.
Well, concerning pain perception, there's a rebound phenomenon where, if you bump your knee today and then come back and bump it the same place tomorrow, it hurts a lot more. Could you shed a little light on that?
Yes, good afternoon, Jim. You're certainly correct in the sense that many times there's something called facilitation, whereby there's a cumulative effect of injury. Of course, the most common that most people are aware of is concussion. It's an additive effect. But certainly an injury to a certain part will sensitize or hypersensitize that region after repeated injuries.
So if you get a knee injury, that kind of thing, you could feel it.
Yes, you may feel it more so. There may be a hypersensitivity if there's repeated injury to that one region.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, we'll go to Carolyn in Poughkeepsie. Carolyn, your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I misunderstood. I thought it was a neurologist, but the question I had, you might still be able to give input on. I was wondering if in your reading and training and updates, if you had an opinion, medical opinion, about the effect of the ongoing use of antidepressants or psychotropics, long-term use and getting off, and whether the synapses would really be able to come back on their own.
Great question, Carolyn. I feel clearly that the less medication, as a general rule of thumb, you take, the better. There's no question that medications have side effects, and even side effects that we don't even know about sometimes yet. And you mentioned antipsychotics, antidepressants. The one that comes to mind that when I was a resident that we used frequently was something called Thorazine. And we really didn't know what the long-term effects were. And, of course, we found out much later that there was something called tardive dyskinesias. With regards to medication, as a general rule of thumb, there is clearly the body's way of accommodating or getting used to the medication, and then you have to come off the medication and then go back on. And the perfect example would be many of the Parkinsonian drugs, L-DOPA, levodopa, so on and so forth. But each medication has a certain degree of rebound or getting used to, so to speak.
And the long-term effect of being on something in terms of the synapse being able to do the work after being held up by and forced by the antidepressant action of keeping the synapse open.
Okay, Frank, just very quickly, synapse, can you define that for us?
Yes, of course. A synapse is the junction whereby the nerve itself is the space or cleft that connects with to the another nerve and or a muscle. So the synapse is the area where a pre-synaptic nerve usually is fired. It releases a chemical into the synaptic cleft, and that chemical goes to the postsynaptic, either nerve or muscle, to facilitate an action. And so that's what the synapse is. But with regarding to medications' use of synapses, they are both excitatory and inhibitory. So you are correct. It depends on the medication and whether or not it's excitatory or inhibitory. But as a general rule of thumb, what happens is that the nervous system does accommodate or get used to a certain drugs, thereby needing more medication sometimes.
And maybe not being able to do the job on its own if someone was weaned off it slowly.
Correct.
As effectively.
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And you're very welcome.
And it's sort of long-term, right? I mean, who knew when half the country was taking certain medications to control blood pressure or other things that, you know, you're going to have other ancillary issues?
Absolutely. And there's no way of knowing without tincture of time. In other words, there's no way to predict except long-term use and then finding out thereafter that these problems pop up.
Thank you, Carolyn. Okay, we're going to go to Tony in Grand Isle. All right, Tony in Grand Isle, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I have a question. I have a vasovagal syncope, is what I guess it's called.
Syncope, yes, Tony.
And I'm wondering if that's something you deal with.
As a neurosurgeon, I deal with structural problems. Vasovagal syncope is not a structural problem. However, it is a response to a stimuli or situation. And some people become vasovagal at the drop of a hat with very little stimulus or input. Others are virtually faint-free, so to speak. So this is not a surgical problem.
But what is it? What is it, Doc?
Yeah, vasovagal syncope is where you syncope by definition is essentially where you faint.
I see.
And vasovagal meaning that it's believed to be understood that the vagal nerve is involved, which is the longest wandering parasympathetic nerve in the body that, once it's stimulated, could cause you to faint. And that could be due to any reaction, a smell, a sight, a sound, a visual stimulus, so on and so forth.
Thank you, Tony.
Mine seemed to be based on somewhat empathy. Like I could watch a cat have its blood taken and suddenly get faint. I know that there's something to do with seafood that might have a problem. I have a little trouble now when I go to restaurants. I'm a performing musician, which really causes a problem because I have to take medicine. I take Klonopin, but only as needed, and I don't seem to be addicted to it. I can go off of it if I'm home for long lengths of time. I've had CBT training, and I've also had hypnosis. Some of those help a little bit. But I'm just, you know, it's a real bane of my existence.
Yes. Yes.
Because it really can interrupt, especially if I go see someone in the hospital. I can't go visit anyone because I have to take medicine to do that, which I'm, you know, I do because I want to see the people.
Okay, Tony, hold on 1 second. We're running out of time here. Doc, anything else to say on this?
Yeah, real quick again, Tony, everybody's different. Everyone has different stimuli. The question is, how do you get around it? How do you cope with it? And there are coping mechanisms that you can discuss with your physician that might help you.
Thank you, Tony. Okay, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Colby Attorneys Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for legal and professional community. Since 1939, ColbyService.com. Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, contact lenses, and eye exams since 1953. Now accepting toy donations for Toys for Tots through the end of the year. Sheehy Opticians.com. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org. Hudson Wine Merchants in Hudson, New York, offering selections for holiday meals, gifts, and everyday wines. Curbside service and delivery available. Raise your glass, HudsonWines.com. And from Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, introducing Dr. Joseph Popper, orthopedic surgeon arriving from Mayo Clinic, working to alleviate back pain using new methods for spine surgery. Partnering with Dr. John Shen, NLH.org, for more information.
We are back with Dr. Frank Genovese, a neurosurgeon practicing out of Ellis Medicine in Schenectady, New York. Great to have you here, Frank. Okay, let's go to Peter in Hurley. All right, Peter in Hurley, you're on. Go. Peter.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I can hear your callers, Alan, but I can't hear from the studio very well. I'm 85 and have a hearing problem.
Okay, well, me too. So we'll do our best to speak up. Okay, what's your problem?
I was diagnosed with spinal stenosis 8 years ago here in the Hudson Valley and told by a highly reputable MD neurologist that there was nothing that could be done from a neurology point of view. He sent me to a physical therapist to do five exercises, which I've been doing for 8 years. My question is there anything new?
Well, good afternoon, Peter. Again, you mentioned neurologist. If you truly have spinal stenosis, that is a stenosis by definition is narrowing. So whether or not it's a narrowing of the spinal canal or narrowing...
I'm sorry, doctor. Could you speak a little louder?
No, he can't. Can you turn up your radio a little louder?
I don't have my radio on. I was told to leave it off.
Oh, well, we can't do anything about it. I'm just checked with our crack engineer, Zach Malloy, who says, no, you'll have to...
I can hear your callers very well.
Yeah, well, that's just the way it is. He's holding up his...
Well, doctor, what do you think? Try again, please, briefly, and then I'll let you go.
Peter, what I would do is I would speak with a neurosurgeon. Yes. The neurologist is the medical counterpart. They deal with medical issues. Stenosis is, in my opinion, a surgical issue. So there are things that can be done for spinal stenosis. Certainly, physical therapy is one. Epidural steroid injections is another. Surgery is a last resort, but certainly a possibility. So check with your local neurosurgeon.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Bye.
All right. We're going to hang that one up. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are 100%. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Marty in Kingston. Okay, Marty in Kingston, you're on.
Hey, guys. Great show. Appreciate you having me on. I was just wondering if about DBS stimulation regarding Parkinson's. I know it's one of the advancements that were made to treat Parkinson's symptoms, but it's only a sort of a temporary solution. And ultimately, the dopamine is no longer secreted in Parkinson's people, you know, ultimately feel the full effects of the disease and pass. But has progress been made beyond DBS brain stimulation to treat Parkinson's? And what's sort of going on with Parkinson's? I know it's not the doctor's specialty, but just curious. Thanks. Back to you guys.
Yes. Good afternoon, Marty. You are correct with the Parkinson's disease and the decreased secretion of dopamine in the substantia nigra. When I was starting training, we were just starting with implant surgery regarding fetal cell tissue into the substantia nigra. However, courtesy of one of our presidents, there was a moratorium on fetal stem cell research, and eventually deep brain stimulation, being the extreme of the treatments, is certainly one form of treatment for Parkinson's disease. But again, it would depend on what is the main form thrust of the presentation of the Parkinsonism. Is it the gait problem? Is it the mental issue? Is it the generalized slowness? Is it the cognitive difficulties? Again, it would depend on the main symptom, and deep brain stimulation certainly is the forefront and extreme treatment in Parkinson's at this time. I'm not familiar with anything making a substantial difference otherwise.
Have we restarted anything with the fetal cells, or is that still sort of in hiatus?
There's no question. Yeah, there's no question that stem cell research clearly is making a comeback and will, in my opinion, probably, if not revolutionize medicine, certainly well on its way. The fetal part of the stem cell is what they are not doing anymore. They're able to convert adult stem cells back to the fetal status and then reimplant those rather than taking fetal tissue itself.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we'll go to, who's that? Who's knocking on my door there? Okay. Let's see. We'll go to Brad. Okay. Brad, you're going to be on. Brad, you're on.
Hi. How you doing? Hey, I have a nephew who has a megacisterna magna, sometimes called a posterior fossa arachnoid cyst. Have you ever heard such a thing?
Hi, Brad. Absolutely, but I think you're confusing two different issues. A cisterna magna is just an enlarged space, i.e. the cisterna magna. That is a space at the base of the brain in the back of the skull that is enlarged, and it's usually the subarachnoid space. A arachnoid cyst, by definition, is a cyst, and a cyst is a compartment that has a wall around it. So there's a cystic component to it. So they're really two different entities.
Okay, is there a, I've been told that, like, for instance, he has incontinence sometimes. Is that a side effect of this?
It is possible, but unlikely. Cisterna magna, okay. You don't do anything for. A cyst, if it's enlarging, can be fenestrated.
And what does fenestrated mean?
Fenestration just means a hole in the cyst. You place a hole in the cyst to form a communication between the cyst and the subarachnoid space.
Interesting.
Is that a risky operation?
Any operation is risky, but as far as procedures go, this is a very simple procedure, especially because this is a superficial and it's not a deep brain a procedure.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks.
Here's one quick question, then I'll let you go. Is does it come back, though? You know, if you drain it, does it tend to come back, or is it kind of cured at that point?
It depends on the fenestration. If you make the hole big enough, hopefully it won't. Sometimes and rarely they do recur, and you have to shunt them. But as a general rule of thumb, once you put a hole in the cyst wall, there is no recurrence.
And where does the shunt go to?
The shunt can go into the subarachnoid space from the cyst to the subarachnoid space.
Thanks a lot. Okay.
All right, thanks.
Yes.
Hang up. Thought I did that. Okay, let's go to Bill in Albany. All right, Bill in Albany, you're on.
Hey, how we doing, guys?
Hey, Bill.
Good. Earlier caller talked about Parkinson, and I had a question, a follow up about that. My grandfather on my mother's side had Parkinson's in his later years, and I was wondering if there is a hereditary factor to Parkinson's disease. I mean, I'm 28 years old right now. He had it. He actually had the early stages of it late in his life, so he got the shakes and the memory loss, but not until his 70s or 80s. So I was wondering if there was a hereditary factor to Parkinson's disease.
That is a great question. It is my opinion that almost all disease processes have a genetic component to them. But to say that my uncle had it and I'm going to get it, or my father had it and I'm going to get it, I think you have to be careful with regards to that. I'm not...
That line of thinking.
Yeah. You certainly, if you did a detailed genetic analysis on your DNA, it is my opinion that could probably give you probabilities of whether or not you're at higher risk of developing it later.
So you
in
know
life.
if there's like a genetic predetermination test for Parkinson's?
You know, I have to tell you, I'm not familiar with specific details, but I was led to believe by speaking to someone that they did one of the DNA analyses that you can probably get at a kit. And if you pay the extra money for the genetic component, they tell you whether or not there is a propensity or
like
a likelihood.
Whether or not the gene is present.
Yes,
or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Have a good one.
You too.
Okay, and now we're off to Cindy in Tyringham. Okay, Cindy, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay, good. Yes. Well, I had an accident about 7 years ago and hit the back of my head on the pavement, and I since then have had trouble with an eye and then both eyes, closing periodically for undetermined amounts of times when I've been sitting, rarely when I'm standing. It's gotten worse and worse. I've had three MRIs, a CAT scan. I've talked to several neurologists, one neurosurgeon, two neurosurgeons, and several different neurologists. And I've been offered several options, ranging from experimental brain surgery to Botox. And I have been, they did in some of those tests determine that I did have a cyst on the pineal gland, but they said it was unchanged in all three MRIs. It was the same. It's not something that seems to be active. And they've ruled out Bell's palsy. They've ruled out a variety of other things that would have jumped to mind. I can't even remember the list, but I'm wondering what you might say that I could do or have done so that I can start to rely on myself a little better.
Yes. Well, hello, Cindy. I'm sorry to hear about your accident and your issues here. However, I just want to tell you right first and foremost that the pineal lesion cyst, whatever you had called it, has nothing to do with your facial problem. Now, when you're dealing with the facial nerve, you have to break it down into whether or not it's central or peripheral. If it's a central issue, i.e. a major head trauma, if the nucleus is involved, then there's probably very little we can do with regards to treatment. If it is a peripheral injury, i.e. outside of the skull, where it comes out of the skull in a little hole called the stylomastoid foramen, if that is injured, there's sometimes transpositions of nerves that we can do. But the likelihood of help has mixed results. So what I would do first and foremost is get involved with your neurologist. And you said you have. And once a structural lesion has been ruled out, i.e. A tumor along the peripheral, the central nervous system, or along the peripheral nerve, a problem at the base of the skull, the stylomastoid foramen, or whether or not there's something along the parotid gland, which is the gland in front of your ear, if there's any swelling or cysts or tumors there, that might make all the difference in the world. So again, it depends on...
It's been ruled out.
Yeah.
If
there's nothing else structurally, then the only other thing I can think of, you need a very aggressive rehabilitation program.
Okay. Do you have any recommendations to make? Where would I look for something like
it
that?
It depends on... Yeah, it depends on where you're living, but what I would do is get involved with your local neurologist, and he or she can give you the best guidance as to the best place locally.
Thank
so
you.
Would that be something like acupuncture or massage or stretching or what?
It may involve all of the above.
Thanks, Cindy. All right, now we're going to go to Lou in Altamont. Okay, Lou in Altamont, you're on.
Howdy. I have two questions. First, if you are described as having a change in gray or white matter lesions, what impact does that have on cognitive function and so forth?
Well, first, the answer to that, Lou, it depends on where and how many. When I was a resident, that we used to call them UBOs, unknown bright objects. When the MRI first came about in wide use, we really didn't know what they were. Then we found out that they're probably related to microvascular disease. Then we find out there are many other disease entities that involved deep white matter, including MS, not only, of course, but MS. So it depends on how many, where they are. Are they deep? Are they central? Are they near central Semio Valley? It depends on location.
So let's get this straight for all of our listeners. When you do an MRI, you're going to see these things?
It depends on many factors, age being first and foremost. As we all get older, we many times see what we call deep white matter changes. In and of themselves, they are meaningless.
Okay. And are they all over the brain? Is that what happens?
They're usually in the white matter of the brain, and they can be bilateral. They can be on one side. They can be on both sides. It may or may not be related to microvascular disease.
Are they like clumps?
These are just abnormal signals picked up on an MRI.
I see. And the gray matter?
And the white matter.
No, I'm asking now about his other point, the gray matter.
Okay. What was the question about the gray matter?
The same question.
Oh, yes. Well, you see it much less likely in gray matter. With holes or lesions in the gray matter, you wouldn't be calling them a white matter disease. It would possibly be due to a neurodegenerative problem, cortical atrophy. The cortex, of course, is gray matter. So it depends. Usually you don't see those kind of changes in the gray matter.
So can we associate, I guess Lou's question is, white matter with a particular disease?
You may, and MS is, of course, the prototypical one.
All right. My second question is, replacement aortic valves done with the TAVI procedure, the insertion through the vein, do they have any impact on cognitive function?
Anytime you're dealing with a vascular structure, it may or may not have an impact on the brain. It may have an impact on the brain due to a disruption in flow, resulting in a disruption of oxygen to the brain, or it may result in something flipping off the vessel. For example, a little tiny plaque of cholesterol or a little tiny blood clot that may or may not flip off, but that would have to be directly after the takeoff from the heart. So the heart, of course, there's a filter. The lungs would pick up most of that before it gets to the brain. However, if there's pathology or involvement of the vessels that are immediately in front of the brain, then any manipulation can cause a problem with the brain.
Thank you, Lou. Okay, let's go now to Timothy in Scotia. Timothy in Scotia, your turn.
Thank you very much. I've had PD perhaps as long as 35 years.
For those of us who are idiots, PD is?
Parkinson's disease.
Except now I'm on my third neurologist. The first one who diagnosed me, I think, I'll go ahead and say, I think he practiced too many years. He practiced well into his 70s and he let some things slide on me that got me an overdose. I'm not thinking of suing. I'm not looking to, but I'm wondering how to avoid, who to talk to when you suspect that maybe your doctor is not totally on top of things anymore.
Get another physician.
Get an immediate second opinion, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, because my second opinion led me to a neurologist at AMC who I feel maybe now has been going into too much clinical research, so I'm on a third neurologist at Ellis. He has suggested that I should have a DAT scan. He's more than suggested. He said, Dr. Brooks said that he thinks I need one.
Okay, let's avoid. Let's avoid naming doctors on the outside. I don't want to do that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. Now,
I was told he had a sparkling reputation.
I'm sure he does. Frank, maybe you could tell us a little bit about this.
Again, is this dealing with the Parkinson's disease?
Most probably because he has an immediate question, the neurologist, when he tells me whether I have Parkinson's disease or I have an active brain tumor.
Yes, well, obviously, sir, there's a big difference between the two.
It's a huge, you know.
Obviously. So you need to, that first and foremost needs to be teased out. And what I would do is just speak with a neurologist that you're comfortable with and let him or her tease that out, because that's obviously a huge difference.
I've already had an hour and a half appointment with him with my wife present, and answered a ton of questions. What he's saying is it's all monolateral. It's all right side of my body. There's virtually no symptoms of Parkinson's disease on the left side of my body, except under extreme
tension. We're running out of time here. Doc,
real quick, usually Parkinson's involves both sides of the body. To have a unilateral problem would give rise to the suspicion of a possible tumor. But you would know real quick if you had a tumor because of an imaging study, and I'm sure you've probably had one.
I had a CAT scan that showed a rather large meningioma right on the upper right lobe, right on the surface, right over a, synapses. It's like a switching.
What I think you have is two problems. You may or may not have Parkinson or Parkinson's features, or you may have Parkinsonian disease, but in addition to, you have a structural problem, meningioma, which in my opinion can certainly cause the unilateral symptoms.
Okay, Timothy.
How often do they go bad?
Can't talk anymore. We got to take a break. Thank you
very much,
Tim. Bye. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996. iMediaConsult.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering flexible schedule graduate social work degree options at the open house tomorrow, November 28th, from 6 to 8 p.m. in Poughkeepsie. adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years. In the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital. ACTSURG.com. Schenectady County Historical Society and the YWCA Northeastern New York, presenting the Festival of Trees, galleries filled with lighted fir trees, and seasonal ambiance. December 1st through 17th, SchenectadyHistorical.org. And from Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors. Serving the Northeast since 2001, StonesoupConcrete.com and on Facebook.
Welcome back. We are delighted to have Dr. Frank Genovese here, a neurosurgeon practicing out of Ellis Hospital in Schenectady, New York. We have several people on the phone. Let's get as much in as we possibly can. Let's go to Wes in Half Moon. Okay, Wes, short question, good answer. Go ahead.
Okay. I have superficial siderosis. And when I was first diagnosed about 5 years ago, they did a scan of my spine, but they can't find the source of the bleeding. Are there symptoms that would be going on when bleeding is occurring? The one drug that they're treating me with is like almost $5,000 a month. And I'm soon be transitioning off my insurance plan onto Medicare.
Okay, good question, Wes. Let's ask Doctor what, first of all, for the rest of us, what's superficial siderosis is. Doctor?
Yes. Wes, I'm confused. A siderosis in the sense that you have hyperpigmentation in the skin? Is that what I'm hearing?
No. Yeah, most doctors don't know what it is. There's only 100 of us in the country. I have a bleed into my spinal column somewhere. And once the blood gets in, it can't cross the blood-brain barrier. And as it breaks down in its components, the iron attaches itself to the cerebellum, so I have severe ataxia. It attaches to the eighth cranial nerve, so I have hearing loss. I have no sense of smell, because I'm sure, it's hit that as well. And I'm on a chelation drug right now, but I don't know
you know, if I'm still bleeding. I don't know if I'm shoveling sand against the tide or, you know, the MRIs of the brain itself, you know, really don't show much change.
Yeah.
Hold on, Wes.
We're going to get an answer now. Go ahead.
Okay, Wes. Okay. Well, what I would say first and foremost is obviously you need a specialist in the field, i.e. a hematologist. Okay? So the hematologist hopefully will be able to tell you whether or not there's a familial disposition to your bleeding, quote unquote.
What is familial?
No, familial meaning congenital or family oriented.
Yeah, oh,
or,
I see. Familial.
So
yeah.
Now the answer to your question is it depends on how many bleeds, how big they are, and where they are. Siderosis, if you're talking in as a general term, may be a systemic problem. And that's what I think I'm hearing with you, where you're bleeding and the blood is being resorbed and being taken up at certain tissues in the body. And that's why I said to you, is it superficial in the skin? Because that's where we most commonly see it.
No, they call it superficial because the top of the brain.
Yeah. No,
it's all black.
Yeah, well, you got to find out what the cause is if you can. So it depends.
It's trauma.
Okay, well, I don't know if
I had whiplash, you know, maybe 20 years ago, and they believe, you know, I have some kind of micro bleed going on somewhere.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have micro bleeds from trauma 20 years ago. So the question is, do you have a propensity to bleed from another underlying problem? So what I would do is make sure that you don't have something called cavernomas. A cavernoma is something that we see very frequently in neurosurgery that bleed, but these bleeds typically are not catastrophic. That occur multiple places. They may or may not be symptomatic, and I don't know if that's in fact what you have. But the one of the easy ways to try to jump on top of this is to get an MRI of the brain and see if you have something called cavernoma. And if that's the case, that might be the reason why you're bleeding and having the iron deposition in the different tissues.
Thank you, Wes. Okay, and now we're going to go to Taylor in Saugerties, number 9. Okay, Taylor, thanks for your patience and hanging in there. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
In 2014, I had a spinal fusion for scoliosis from 57 degrees to now it's 17 degrees. And about a year later after that, the left side of the fusion was with hooks and the right side was with screws. And so the right side, the screws started coming out on the top. And I was wondering if that's because of my body composition. Like, does this happen often or is it because the surgeon did the surgery incorrectly? That's my first question.
Okay, Taylor, well, to answer the first question, not necessarily. I don't believe that the surgical procedure was necessarily done wrong just because there's failure of hardware. It is my opinion that you probably had something called adjacent level disease. And what happens is that whenever you do a fusion, you have to understand that the level above and below the fusion take the brunt of the movement. So in other words, wherever the surgeon stopped the fusion, there's going to be increased wear and tear at that level. And if that's in fact the case, that level tends to get bad later on. So not having the luxury of seeing your films or knowing exactly where the fusion ends or stops, I can't really comment further. However, there are junctional levels. There's levels, i.e., for example, between the thoracic spine and the lumbar spine. If you stop there and you don't cross that level, you're at increased risk
for having a problem.
Yeah. So the question is not
you
having...
L4.
Yeah, the question is, did they go above or below? You know, so it's very hard for me to comment. But yes, there is something called adjacent level disease that's fairly common, and it depends on the literature, but anywhere from 3% to 7% to 20%, depending upon who you read and what you believe.
Taylor, I hope you understand, but there are a lot of people queued up here, so we're going to let you go. Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. And now we're going to go to Ann in Scotia. Ann in Scotia, you're on.
Hello. I would like to know if normal pressure hydrocephalus is being diagnosed more these days versus 15 to 20 years ago. Because not that it's occurring more frequently, but because the public and especially primary doctors are more alert to it today. as a possible diagnosis as versus dementia.
Okay, doctor, first of all, would you tell us what the term means, normal pressure hydrocephalus?
Hydrocephalus.
Yeah.
NPH, or normal pressure hydrocephalus, is an entity whereby the ventricles in the brain enlarge for whatever reason. And Anne, I certainly agree with you. When I was a resident, there was certainly the entity of NPH, but now it seems to be much more common.
So they are finding it more.
It appears to be that way. We're much more sensitive in making the diagnosis now because imaging studies are much more prevalent.
Good. Well, and I would hope that primary doctors and families are more aware of that as a possible diagnosis. Because I had a friend who had it, and I came up with a diagnosis.
Yeah.
I read an article. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is what he has.
Okay, so
and
what
he
I
hasn't been treated.
Okay, so what I want to know is, what are the manifestations of that?
NPH is manifested by an acronym called DIG, D-I-G, Dementia, Incontinence to Urine or Stool, and Gait Disturbance. Now, I mentioned an imaging problem or a clinical problem. You may or may not be able to tell NPH on an imaging studies. Many times that's how it's picked up. But technically, NPH is picked up clinically with dementia, incontinence to urine or stool, or gait problems.
Thank you, Anne. Let's go to Barbara in Stone.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to Barbara in Stone Ridge. Barbara, you're on.
2012, my sister sustained a traumatic brain injury from a fall, and unfortunately, precious time was wasted because the local hospital could not treat her, and every second counts with a brain injury. And since every day 153 people in the United States die from brain injuries, I was wondering what your opinion is on the need for trauma centers in rural areas, and how do we get doctors more involved with making these needs known and helping to make the changes that need to be made to save lives?
That's a great question, Barbara. Unfortunately, though, localities are such that you can't put resources and have a trauma center in every city. So then it becomes a matter of logistics. One way to kind of circumvent that problem is to have what we call a telecommunication, telemedicine, whereby hopefully some of the rural hospitals are able to have a direct contact with a trauma center and get better guidance and information. But unfortunately, it's not logistically possible to have a trauma center in every city. But I certainly agree with everything you had said.
Unfortunately, there was no surgeon available, you know, to do the surgery, and she waited hours before it could be done.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm terrible about that. I don't know of an easy answer to that question.
Thank you, Barbara. Let's...
Thank you.
I don't get it. I keep saying hang up here, Zach, and it's not hanging up. Okay, let's go to Rich in Perth, New York. Okay, Rich, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My question is regarding a pension herb I have at L4-5. It has given me a slight foot drop. Is there some way I can get strength back in that foot?
Hi, Rich. Yes, certainly if it's a partial foot drop. To me, a foot drop means the foot is dropped. A partial foot drop tells me that there's still quite a bit of function involved, and hopefully it will improve with rehabilitation. But again, it depends on the pathology. Most commonly, a foot drop is an L4-5 problem, but it also can be a problem at the knee where the fibular nerve or the peroneal nerve is involved along the outer aspect of the knee. So it really depends on where the lesion is. But if you don't have a total foot drop and there's not total weakness, then the prospects are pretty good that you will improve with aggressive rehabilitation.
So physical therapy?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich. Okay. And I apologize for not having turned my phone off. It was not a good thing. Let's see here. Ben in Sharon, Connecticut. All right, Ben, you're on.
Hi, I had a question. I had a burst fracture in the bottom of my thoracic spine, and I lost function of my legs and have since regained most of it. Now, I still have impairment, though. Is there some other part of the body that gets a permanent partial disability rating other than the thoracic spine if you're having neurological deficit in your legs?
Yes, you can have a problem in the cervical spine that gives you a paresis in the lower extremities, but generally speaking, it also involves the arm. So anywhere from the lowest cervical segment down to the cauda equina can give you a paraplegia. If you go below that and just involve the nerves in your leg, if you were to have severance of those nerves, you can also have a paraplegia or a paraparesis or weakness.
And what are those for the rest of us?
Yeah. Of course, a plegia means that you're totally paralyzed, but paresis means you're weak. So it depends on the lesion. Yes, it could be anywhere from the, if it's just your legs, it could be anywhere from the very bottom part of the cervical spine down.
Thank you, Ben.
So,
go ahead. Go ahead.
What is the part that receives the rating other than the thoracic spine then at that point? Like, what is the body part that they rate?
Yeah, I think they rate function, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not familiar with the scale you're talking about, but if I had to guess on what I'm hearing, it's probably the functionality of your movement, whether it's motor, whether it's sensory, so on and so forth.
Thank you, Ben. Okay, now let's go to Chuck in Kingston. All right, Chuck, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
I have a question about the non-headache migraines. And I have auras, which I know, you know, I can feel them come. I can see them and all that stuff. But I have a question about when I get up in the morning, I have a flickering around my eyes. It's like a fan is turning on the ceiling when the lights are dim. And it's just kind of like, flipping around. It's like the shadow is going across the top of my eye. Is that part of an aura? Is that a part of a non-headache migraine?
That's a great question, Chuck. I'm not sure what you mean by a non-headache migraine. Migraines, by definition, cause headache. So what I think I'm hearing is that you're having headaches that are not migraineous. Is that a fair question?
Well, I'm not having headaches. I'm having auras.
Okay. That's not a migraine. So auras can be a predisposition to a migraine. But by definition, when you have a migraine, you have a headache. So what I think I'm hearing are are called visual obscurations, which manifest themselves as some of the symptoms that you just described, whether or not it's a flickering light, a flashing light. The important thing to remember is that there's no partial blindness, or i.e. a shade coming down across the field, the visual field. If that's the case, then that would warrant a workup. But no, you may have pre-migraine.
Chuck, thank you. All right, now let's go to Jeff in upstate New Jersey, it says here. Okay, Jeff, you're on.
Hi, how you doing? July 31st, 1976, I rolled a 57 Chevy, resulting in compound fractures to 9, 10, and 11. When I was lying on the side of the car, I heard a gushing sound. It resulted in transient paraplegia, by the way. I heard a gushing sound, and I was bleeding out of my ears. Are you able to tell me why?
Well, bleeding out of the ears can be a bunch of reasons. The most common reason why we see people with blood in their ear is usually a basilar skull fracture, i.e. a fracture that traverses the bottom part of the skull, which is fairly common in motor vehicle accidents of significant trauma. Now, the question is whether or not there was any CSF leak out of your ear. Blood in your ear could be a tear in the ear itself. It could be a crack in the membrane or the canal. It doesn't have to involve the skull. It doesn't have to involve the brain per se. But bleeding in the ear from a neurosurgical standpoint usually implies skull fracture until proven otherwise.
Thank you very much for that. We're going to go to Marty and Colony, and that'll be the last one. And Marty, it's got to be quick. Go ahead, Marty.
Okay, as a doctor, as a neurosurgeon, have you ever dealt with a condition that I'm going to call disequilibrium? And I'm going to define that as a person who loses control of balance and posture, as separate from vertigo, where the person feels he is spinning, and from lightheadedness, where the person is feeling fainted.
Okay, so we're running out of time, Marty. So
disequilibrium.
Okay, Marty, that's a great question. Yes, I have, but usually that's the realm of the neurologist. I deal with disequilibrium when there are structural problems involving the brain, i.e. brain tumors, cysts, along those lines.
So that condition could mean there are brain tumors.
It is possible. It could be a brain bleed. You would best start with the neurologist, have him or her tease that out. And if there's a structural problem, it could possibly be, you may need to see a neurosurgeon. But I would start with the neurologist.
Okay, okay. An MRI back in 2012 showed that there was no, at least at that time, problem as far as cancer, but it's continued on and off for several
years. Sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off because
yep.
we are
it's
out
time.
Of time.
Thank you.
And a big apology to Michelle in Poughkeepsie in Plattsburgh, New York, who got left on the line. But we did pretty well. We're just out of time. My apologies to Michelle. I want to thank Dr. Frank Genovese of Ellis Hutton Medicine for being with us today. Support for the Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our This is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.